From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Do you have a passion for vinyl?
First thing I ever did for the Elton John AIDS Foundation was to sell my vinyl. I had so much of it, I didn't really know what to do with it, so I sold it. And recently, I started collecting vinyl again, and I play vinyl in Vegas and at home, and everyone releases their albums now on vinyl. It's the experience. It's the ritual of looking at the sleeve, getting the album out, putting it on, listening to five tracks, getting up, turning it over. And it sounds so different, I have to say.
LP Records are making a comeback in Georgia. We'll explain why later this hour. But we want you to join this conversation. Does vinyl sound better than digital music? To you, anyway. Or do you prefer the convenience of an MP3? Give us a call and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also post to Facebook or Twitter. We are at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. This summer, our producer Trevor Young visited the annual Shaky Knees Music Festival in downtown Atlanta. He interviewed some unique musicians, including Ron Gallo. The young rocker is perhaps best known for his philosophical musings and carefree attitude. Trevor caught up with him before the fest.
My name is Ron Gallo. I'm a musician based in Nashville. You know, the thing that I've figured out over the last few years is kind of what I feel like music should be used for. And for me, it's mostly a vehicle for the message and what the things that I feel like I need to say to myself or say to the world. So a lot of it stems from certain frustrations with humanity as well as myself and trying to use music to address them. So, you know, that kind of results in a level of confrontation, I think.
Why do you have kids? Why did you make children? You gave all baby daddy's money for food.
Sometimes playing against the crowd, I mean, trying to pull something out of people there, not just get up and play songs and try to sound like the record and create this entertaining experience, but maybe there's elements of discomfort that people feel, or, you know, we try to throw some sense of humor and strange antics to the show, mostly to entertain ourselves, but, you know, sometimes it might be jarring to people. Ultimately, the goal is to have people leave a show maybe questioning something, whether it's themselves or the world around them or how they feel leaving the show.
You beat your son at the grocery store because he cried a little when his eyes were sore. Why?
Anytime I kind of talk about the songwriting process, the example I like to use is the song Why Do You Have Kids on the record. Because as a very straightforward writing process, I got off of a subway in Philadelphia, two blocks from my house, and I just kind of saw some of the imagery in the song. And I ended up asking that question in my head, and I walked two blocks home, and I sat down, and the song just kind of poured out. So it was like the words first. It just started from this very, like, visceral reaction to just seeing something on the street, and then kind of turning it into a song, immortalizing, like these few moments of just seeing these really, like, seedy, strange characters. Black Market Eyes might be my favorite song to play live. I guess I don't really know why. It's one of the songs that's based less on, like, commentary and confrontation. That's more of, like, the other side of me, which I guess is more like emotional impact. It's like a song of feeling as opposed to trying to, like, address a topic or comment on something socially.
She bought new eyes on the black market, the kind where history flies by and is erased by the eyes. Watch the eclipse as the sun drips across her eyelids. Her beast lingers where no one else can.
There's these few moments every time we play it live that are just very in the moment, and there's like a level of intensity, more emotionally driven than, like, you know, just playing like the kind of like fast, more punkish songs. I think the gold is in the mundane sometimes, and just in walking down the street, looking at people. I think that's where, you know, you can kind of find like a lot of the answers to the questions that we have about, you know, being human and what it's all about. So it's really just trying to pay attention all the time to what's going on around and trying to find ways to put it in the song.
Then I taped her eyes open and I crawled into a cell. Yes, I stared until she shuddered.
I always like playing All the Punks Are Domesticated. I think lyrics being the important part to me, I think that's the song that really tied the whole record together, because that song in itself is sort of like all my feelings and thoughts and like the current state of culture and music and food and society, all those things, like all in one 4-minute song.
All of the punks are domesticated. All of the freaks have gone to bed. All of the pioneers are saved for information tech. Oh, wrinkled and dead. They're dead.
When we play that live, I mean, it's mostly just kind of guitar and voice, and then we have a part where it kind of like freaks out in the middle and speeds up, and I always really like playing that live too, because every once in a while there's this really cool moment where like the room will be completely silent at certain points, and that's always just that's such a rare thing to experience, a few hundred people standing in silence in a room. So when that happens, that's like one of the coolest, I think, live experiences.
Has anything to say?
That was musician Ron Gallo, who performed at the Shaky Knees Festival in Atlanta this year. Also at Shaky Knees, Bay Area musician Fantastic Negrito. The soulful artist was the first ever winner of NPR's Tiny Desk Concert. Our producer Trevor Young talked to him too.
There's only one Fantastic Negrito in the world, and I am here in Oakland, California. I think that music probably came a little bit late for me. I was about 17. Now, I really always loved that early Prince work. And Prince, well, I was reading that he just taught himself. So I said, well, if that's good enough for Prince, it's good enough for me. So I would go and I would sneak into the piano rooms at UC Berkeley, just pose as a student. You know, I had sideburns. Well, that time, you know, this was the hustling era in the Bay Area, so it was a lot about, you know, women and selling drugs. I mean, that's what you did. That's what was going on. A lot of street culture. It was thick and it was abundant. If you were young, especially if you were a young black male in Oakland, that's what you were singing and talking about. And that's what was around me. And I think it was pretty traumatic, you know, in a sense, you know, especially the proliferation of, back then it was crack cocaine. It was pretty traumatic because you saw whole neighborhoods going down like the Titanic. You saw communities dissolving. And probably too young to really understand what it was, but you knew that it was just traumatic. I think we have like a responsibility always to be the tellers of truth, you know, because, you know, politicians won't do it and people can be bought off so easily. And so I tend to write about what's going on in my environment. The last days of Oakland.
The Black Panthers.
There was so much happening.
The end of something.
Crack cocaine.
And the beginning of something. I think, like I wrote The Last Days of Oakland, I wrote about how I felt about that, how Oakland was a changed city, not changing, but changed. And some people that are born in Oakland or San Francisco, they may grow up and not be able to afford to even live in their own hometown. And these things need to be addressed. You know, the Bay Area, we're an edgy tribe, but that's why I describe us.
I'm really down now.
I like Rant Rushmore. That's one of my favorite songs to play off the album. It's very provocative, and people kind of misunderstand it sometimes, and I guess as an artist, I get a kick out of that. That's what we're here for. If it's not uncomfortable a little bit, then I don't really know what it is.
Most of my fear sitting right here with you. For the rest of my life, and all this pain from the games that your mamas and your daddies played and abused.
So, no, Rant Rushmore, I know it's a song about love. I always call it the dark side of love. It's a side of love that is not popular in film. It's a side of love that's it's not really romantic, but it's very real, like unconditional love. Like I learned it from being the survivor of a 3-week coma and losing my playing ability in my hands, is that I really learned that the people that stuck around, and I mean, that was love. There was nothing in it for them. And that was so profound to me. Well, I was just getting back into it, and I was a bit of a street performer because I had walked away from music for 5 years. Really had no interest. I didn't have anything to say. And then when I started finding that I may have something to contribute, because for me, at this point in my life, that's what it was really about. Like, man, if you're going to do it, you have to be a contributor. I think when I won Tiny Desk, which was unexpected, it just kind of put that trajectory on steroids. And I'm very grateful to Bob Boylan for shining the light on me and just understanding what I was trying to contribute.
This bird at my window, she watches it all.
Every time someone asks me about Fantastic Negrito, I'm gonna say the names of those kings who were so innovative and died broke, but they were so innovative and contributed so much to the world that we live in now. And I felt it was my responsibility, since they inspired me, I would say their names, and I will keep saying their names every time people ask me about Fantastic Negrito. And it's really just a celebration of Black roots music and this culture that came out of misery, that came out of slavery and sharecropping. And then this music, out of this darkness came this bright light. And that's kind of the way I see life, is that out of a lot of misery and darkness can come such beauty.
I try to hide in the hole. There's a hole in my head.
That was musician Fantastic Negrito speaking with producer Trevor Young earlier this year. Just ahead, the case for listening exclusively to vinyl. But first, a final send-off for one of Cartoon Network's most beloved characters, Samurai Jack. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. One of the most popular shows on Cartoon Network came back this year for a final season.
Long ago in a distant land, I, Aku, the shape-shifting master of darkness, unleashed an unspeakable evil. But a foolish samurai warrior wielding a magic sword stepped forth to oppose me.
That's the intro to the first run of Samurai Jack. It ran 4 seasons from 2001 to 2004, but the show was canceled before the storyline reached its end. Samurai Jack has become a cult classic in the animation world, and responding to growing demand, the creators revived it for a fifth season. It premiered on Atlanta-based Adult Swim in March, and I spoke about the much-anticipated new season with the original creator, Gindy Tartakovsky. Also with us, series art director Scott Wills. You know, there's been a lot of headlines about the return of Samurai Jack, and one of my favorites said that Samurai Jack is back, and they said, deeper, darker, more violent. Gindy, is that fair?
It's kind of fair. I mean, you know, it's definitely deeper because emotionally we're going to places where we haven't really gone. Darker, it's just a darker part of Jack's life where we're kind of jumping in. So that's probably true. And then more violent, yes, but we're really, you know, we're really trying to still do it tastefully and still to the style of the show. It's not going to be gory just for gore's sake. It's still very kind of story motivated.
So I want to read you this description of your original pitch that Mike Lasso said, and I'm really hoping, Gindy, that you will confirm this. Lasso's an executive Cartoon Network, and he said this about you pitching him this series. He said, hey, remember David Carradine in Kung Fu? Wasn't that cool? And I was like, yeah, that's really cool. That was literally the pitch.
It was close to that. The way I remember it was definitely that was kind of part of it. But then I said, it's a samurai in the future. He kills robots. No dialogue. Super stylized. And he said, that
he
sounds
said,
great.
Go?
Yep.
Which was a huge departure from Dexter's Laboratory, your hit before this.
Yeah. And I mean, for me, like as a filmmaker, I always want to try different things. And, you know, we did Dexter and then we did Powerpuff Girls. And I was kind of burnt out on dialogue. I was burnt out on a lot of things. And I've always complained about every other animated action show. And so I decided, well, maybe it's time for me to step up and see if I could deliver what I want an animated action show to be. And that was kind of the premise, is just, you know, the samurai. I love the lore of samurai, the mythology, and throw them in the future. Basically because we can't kill humans on TV back then. So we, you know, got to have them fight something. And that kind of how the two kind of things came together.
So, Scott, what has changed from the art direction? I mean, Samurai, again, you just said, it's very stylized. And the style of it that I guess is called retro-futuristic, whatever that means. It's you use a lot of black space. There's a lot of masking. There's no outlines. What has changed in the new series?
Well, honestly, I wasn't trying to change anything originally. I think I was concerned with just matching the look of the old show, which is a little strange coming back to it 12 years later. But the realities of production, one thing has changed is we do things more digitally now, more in the computer. So the backgrounds now are painted in computer, which is a big difference. So it was my test to try to match the old show in computer, but thematically get more dramatic, moody backgrounds this time around because of the story.
So, Gindy, I know that you've said you don't want to give anything away about this new season, including even among the first episodes. So I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes trying to make you give things away.
Go for it.
We'll see how successful I am. I mean, for example, just from watching the trailer, and I've watched it a bunch of times, as I'm sure a lot of people have.
50 years have passed, but I do not age.
How much longer can you keep this up?
Time has lost its effect on me. Yet, the suffering continues.
You've forgotten your purpose!
Aku's grasp chokes the past, present, and future.
Number one, he's quite a bit older. You find out right away that it's 50 years later, but he doesn't seem to have his dad's magic katana anymore. What happened to the sword? Can you tell me?
Well, we just left those scenes out of the trailer. So it's a mystery if he has it or not. But what I can say is that, yeah, Jack is, it's 50 years into the future from the last episode, and he hasn't aged. So he's stuck in this kind of, you know, in this horrific place where he's at. He can't get home. He can't kill Aku. He can't find him.
Aku is the
and
big
so
bad guy.
What, yeah. Yeah. And what are you going to do? Like, if you're just stuck in this basically this hell place of a limbo, and what happens is he's lost his way, you know. And so whatever that means to the sword, whatever that means to his psyche, he's completely lost his path, you know. And that's one of the great things is how do you bring a hero back when he's down.
And Scott, that ends up looking very different to me, anyway, to my eyes at least. It looks different on Jack. I mean, the first thing you notice is he has a gigantic beard. He's not very well kempt anymore. His hair is loose. But what other kind of things change in his appearance?
Well, I think he's taller now. He's kind of sleeker. So he just looks more heroic, I think, this time around.
From a general sense of the art direction that we did this time around is that, you know, we did Jack 12, 13 years ago. Right. So we're all kind of different artists. And so that affects the way we draw. You know, we have different things that we're into. And so we're not going to draw Jack exactly the way we drew him back then because we're different. And it's also one of the things that we were kind of struggling against is people's perception. Because never before have we done a show where the public already likes it. And they liked it even worse when they were children. So they have this whole idea of how Jack is in their minds. And that happened to me in my career also where, you know, I grew up loving cartoons, loving like, you know, dumb 70s shows like Dynamite and Hong Kong Phooey. And when you're 10 or whatever, those things are amazing. And then when I started at Hanna-Barbera, I watched them. I'm like, oh, my God, these are terrible. And that was one of the biggest things that I was afraid of is that we're going to give the public or the fans of the show, we have to match up to their memory of the show, which is an impossibility. And so we took that pressure off of us and we're like, you know what? We're going to do the show the way we've always wanted to. And the story dictates everything. It dictates a darker art direction. It dictates a more moody, darker version of Jack. And at the end of the day, it still feels the same, even though it has this slightly darker sensibility.
So the guy that voices Jack is Phil LaMarr.
What do I like most about voicing Jack? It's the easiest job in show business. He says like four lines. Then there'll be like some other guy's like, well, let me explain the whole plot of the story. And I just go, I see, I will find it. And then I'm gone.
Would you have been able to do this without Phil? Would you have been able to do it with a different voice actor?
I mean, you know, I love Phil and he's amazing and he is Jack for sure. It's hard, but I think for any other show, I would say no. But I think because it's Jack, there's like 2 minutes of dialogue, I think, in the first episode, you know. And I think Phil would contest to this too, is that he knows the visuals and the visual storytelling is number one for this show. And so I think the voices take a back seat. You know, as much as we love him, of course, and Phil, I'm sorry, but no, I think it would have survived. Of course, you never wanted to. And, you know, the challenge of replacing Mako, who was the original voice of Aku, was impossible.
Who dares to summon the master of masters, the deliverer of darkness, the shogun of sorrow, Aku?
But, you know, I know that when we lost the voice of Dexter, Christine Cavanaugh, like she was the integral part of that show and there was no way I would do more episodes without her. And, you know, people have talked about doing more Dexters and I said, no way. There's no way anybody could replace it because it's so specific, you know. And even though Jack's voice is specific, it's definitely, you know, we would have him talk even less.
So, Scott, you know, there have been a number of discussions over the past 12 years about what you guys could or couldn't do because Samurai Jack was on Cartoon Network. I think I read one where they said that there was a mention that you couldn't show the rear view of a dog. What what have you been freed?
That's the current.
Yeah. Oh, that's current?
That's the current complaint. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. But what are you able to, how are you maybe limited or unlimited? What's changed in what you can do? Because you're now on the adult version.
Well, I don't think we had limitations back then that affected us. I think we did what we wanted to do. We couldn't kill humans before, but I keep hearing that we're killing people. There's blood now. because we can. And I don't think we're doing it just because we can. I think it's part of the story. Right, Gandhi? I don't think...
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing. Yeah, before... We definitely, you know, the thing about the everything that we've ever made is we don't do it specifically for kids because I don't know what a kid likes. Scott doesn't know what a kid likes. So we do it for each other and for the crew. And if all of us like it, we're hoping everybody will like it. And that makes it more sincere. We have more, I think, mentally intense things than physical, you know, gore. Because I think initially when we got into it doing it, maybe it was a little bit like, oh, yeah, let's just, you know, decapitate heads and have fountain of blood. But then we realized that's not what Jack is. It's still, we still have to be true to the show. And then when Jack does kill a human, my favorite thing about this is he actually reflects on it and we draw attention to that idea rather than just doing violence for violence sakes just because we can.
So for those who haven't seen this series, it ended with a cliffhanger, which is that Jack was constantly trying to get back to his own time so he could stop Aku from taking over the world. He lives in a future time, Jack does, in which Aku is basically the master of the world, and he wants to get back and stop that from happening. And we never saw the resolution of that story when the show ended. So for 12 years, have you known how that story would end? Or did you have to, or did you change it when you finally got around to coming back to the series?
No, pretty much I maybe like a year after we finished and then we finished Clone Wars. And then the first chance I got to kind of think, I had the story in my head of what story I wanted to tell for the finish, because it's not directly linked to him going back, even though obviously that's going to be a part of it. But I knew what theme I wanted to do. And I don't want to say it because I don't want to give it away until it's a great reveal. So I knew what theme I wanted to tell, and then all the details around it were changed along the way. But it really is this one story that I had in my mind.
But one of the things that made Samurai Jack so famous, legendary in some places, is the fight scenes. So have those changed, that style that sort of is almost the Ronin, almost Akira Kurosawa, has that morphed along with the 50 years that have passed?
Yeah, for sure. I think when we got into it, it was, how do we top ourselves, number one? You know, and then, you know, the one nice thing about Jack is that when it came out, it did influence a lot of things after it. Even though it was completely influenced from all those things before, you know, Kurosawa, 70s filmmaking, Sergio Leone, all those things weren't original. We just kind of put them together and shook them up, and it came out feeling more unique. And so now it's been imitated quite a bit. And so, you know, there's probably less split screen stuff than we did before. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was kind of kitschy after all this time. But we wanted to do something different. So we've done more. I think that choreography is a bit different, and I think we're just better. Mm. You know, after 12 years of doing a lot of different things, we kind of know more directly where to go with things. And because the story is stronger, it really comes back to that we're facilitating the action to this greater story. So everything has a better intensity and better visceral quality to it. I think that's kind of the best way to explain it.
I probably won't be able to get you to tell me which characters come back in addition to Samurai Jack, but there's these cool female ninjas in the trailer that look really neat. And I wonder which are the best, I mean, besides Samurai Jack, who's the most fun to draw? Because the Scotsman is a perennial favorite to watch.
Excuse me.
What do you expect me to do?
Just stand aside.
And risk falling over the side for a perfect stranger? Away and bile your head. You stand aside.
But I wonder who's the most fun to draw.
I mean, definitely Jack is not fun to draw. It is a labor. I was just on our drive here. I was telling Scott how I've been struggling because I wanted to look so good in my head a certain way. And it's hard. It's hard to get it that way. And so he is not fun. But those girls are definitely fun to draw. And yeah, the Scotsman, you know, I've said before that he's definitely coming back. And I think Aku,
is Aku fun to draw.
Aku is fun to draw because, you know, he could be very expressive and he is just a very simple graphic idea. And he's probably the most fun for sure.
Okay. So my last question, and this is if somebody's watched this from the very beginning, they know that Jack is not this guy's name and we never actually learn his name. So why? How come we never learn his name?
It felt, I had names in the beginning, but that all felt cheesy, you know. It didn't feel sincere. Sometimes the mystery of it makes it more interesting. And so for whatever reason, and I don't want to confuse him, I don't want to confuse the Jack part of it, you know. And so if we found out his name, then people would then call it that. Then why doesn't he call himself that? It opened up too many questions. So I thought I could probably get away with it, his dad calling him son.
Right.
You know, and prince. Yeah, and the prince or whatever. And so I didn't feel it needed because his name is Jack. In this world, in this future, he has taken up to be Samurai Jack.
That was Genndy Tartakovsky, creator of Cartoon Network's Samurai Jack. We also spoke with the art director for the series, Scott Wills. Just ahead, Vanessa Briscoe-Hay of Pylon adds some tunes to our Georgia playlist. And get your turntable out. We're spinning some wax. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Vinyl records are back in style. You could chalk that up to hipster millennials or the persistence of dedicated audiophiles. Whatever the reason, folks are buying analog music again. Kindercore Vinyl in Athens is the newest and only vinyl pressing plant in Georgia. I spoke with Kindercore President Ryan Lewis back in July.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being with us. What does Kindercore mean?
Okay, well, back in the 90s, around 96, we were in Athens in bands and started a record label, a friend of mine and I, and just to sort of put out our own record and document our friends that were doing stuff. And so we had to come up with a name for it, which in the beginning we weren't taking it very seriously, so we just sort of made up this joke name on just sort of how there were all these subgenres in music that all had core on the end, like, you know, hardcore, emo core, grindcore, whatever. And so we just came up with a silly one because everybody in town referred to us as kids because we were all like 20. So Kindercore was born then, and we ran it as a record label until the early 2000s. And then when we decided to do this, we figured we'd bring it back.
I wonder how closely that sort of parallels the rise of vinyl. I mean, I think that when vinyl started selling again, many people thought as sort of a niche market, and that's turning out to be wider spread than people expected. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, you can go into Cracker Barrel and buy vinyl now, amazingly. Apparently, they sell it in Whole Foods. I mean, you can get vinyl really places where you wouldn't have been able to get CDs before. It's sort of incredible how pervasive it's become. And even just noticing it in television, commercials, movies, even like sporting event openings. I think it was like the Super Bowl or something had like turntable visuals, which was sort of amazing to me. But yeah, it's definitely worked its way back into popular culture.
So from your I'm going to read a quote from you from your press release and get you to explain it for me. Right. So this says, because of the explosion in vinyl sales, says Ryan Lewis, keeping up with demand without sacrificing quality has been an industry-wide struggle. What do you mean?
Okay. Well, so actually, one of the interesting things that happened, I mean, like you were saying about our rise and fall as a label and then return as a vinyl plant sort of does follow the arc of the way the industry changed. But so in that sense, a lot of plants in the early 2000s started downsizing and some of them were closing. So once things turned around and demand for vinyl picked up again, I think a lot of plants were caught off guard by that and they had to spend a lot more energy putting people in production positions instead of quality control and customer service. So unfortunately, over the last decade, customer service and quality control have really gone downhill within the industry, I think, because people have just had a hard time scaling back up and keeping up with it. So that's something that we're really focused on addressing, putting out really high-quality records and having really responsive customer service.
So one of the things that you guys use is what's called a warm tone press.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean? And remember that there are people here that maybe who are hearing this who have maybe never used or even touched a vinyl record.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So the process of making records, the actual physical process of melting plastic pellets and squishing them into records, that part of it hasn't changed since the beginning of records. But the what has changed, though, is that for decades there have only been old machines available. So they stopped designing new machines in the late 70s, early 80s. And so all the plants that are out there either have those actual old machines, which is sort of like a Cuba situation where everybody's trying to keep old cars running and you're like buying old machines and taking parts and switching them out with each other. Or they have some newer machines that are basically just the old ones remachined and rebuilt. But the Warmtone, the thing that we're so excited about is it's a new company in Canada called Viral Technology. And they have developed a new press from the ground up that's fully automated. It has digital sensors to make sure that all the temperature and humidity settings are correct. I mean, basically, it's supposed to make more consistent records faster. And we're really excited about that because it's taking an old end product, you know, an old analog end product, but creating it with the benefit of all the modern digital technology. So it's very exciting.
So to what do you attribute the rise in vinyl record sales? Is it just all those hipsters with the beards and the short hair?
Well, as a hipster with beard and sort of shortish hair, I mean, I wouldn't give myself and my peers all the credit for that. But I think really honestly what happened, at least the way that I saw it, because I worked in record stores for years, is that when digital music became so prevalent and people were, you know, downloading things from iTunes or different stores or just pirating music, there was a while there where people, I feel like, weren't really able to give each other music. You couldn't really gift music as easily. You know, it's not very exciting to buy an iTunes gift card and give it to someone and say, hey, I really dig this record. You should go download it. Because for one, they're probably not going to do that. They're going to go download whatever they want. But it's just not that exciting. And the first time that it really hit me that it was coming back in such a big way was a few Christmases ago when I started to notice that people were buying tons of vinyl as presents. And I would be talking to older people who were like, oh, yeah, all my nieces and nephews just want vinyl for Christmas, blah, blah, blah. And so I think what it is sort of bringing us back to, you know, the importance of having something physical and something that, you know, feels like a very tangible artistic creation in your hands versus having something that you download. It's just more personal. And, you know, the size of the art and everything else, it's just, you know, there's something, I think, inherently that we got right as a music industry when vinyl was the dominant form, and nothing has really been able to permanently unseat it because it just sort of is that thing that we love. And, you know, the nice thing about it is that it works really well in conjunction with digital download technology. I mean, personally, I, you know, have a subscription to Apple Music and I paid $9 a month so that I know what record I want to spend $30 on. You know, I don't want to go out and spend $20, $30 on a record that I haven't heard. So I'll listen to it streaming, find what I like, go out and buy it. I think the two work really well together. So in that sense, I think it's exciting. It's not so much a rejection of the new as it is sort of a combination of the best of both things.
But it also changes the way you listen to music, right? I mean, I had
I had
Thriller on vinyl, and they yeah. had to construct those records so that when you – they had to think about what was the first song you hear when mm-hmm. you flipped the disc over, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Number one, I was more likely to listen to the whole thing mm-hmm. as opposed to shuffling all my selections. But they also had to sort of structure it so that there was an intermission break while you were flipping it over.
Absolutely.
What difference does that make?
Well, and actually it goes even further than that because there are physical, not so much limitations, but there's just, you know, there are physical demands and physical realities created by a piece of vinyl spinning that affect where you should put certain kinds of songs. So there are things like, you know, a noisier song should come first and a quieter song should be towards the middle of the record just because of the way that the physics of the whole operation move. And so that kind of stuff is really exciting as well. So you start to think, oh, well, maybe the reason why this album that I love ends with a really, you know, quiet, slow song on the end of side A is because that's what they were thinking about, you know. And also thinking about the time that records could last. In the 70s, when albums became so much of a bigger thing, you had bands trying to push how long an album could be and then eventually pushing more and more into double album sets because there are actually physical limitations about how long a record can be. So in that sense, you combine all those things together, and I think it just gives you a more deliberate album, something that people have spent more time thinking about the intricacies of how it's going to sound in context. And I mean, there's, you know, it's great to get in your car and listen to digital music. It's great to, you know, go for a run or walk the dog or do whatever. But really sitting down at home and putting an album on and listening to it from, you know, beginning to end, both sides, is just something you can't match with digital music. It's just dropping the needle and playing it through and then having to get up and switch it. It's just, it's much more involved. It demands a little more from the listener, I think.
So, Ryan, the trends that we're seeing in terms of purchasing vinyl are often nationwide trends. Is there a market for vinyl in Georgia?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, it's internationally, but yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of the great record stores in Georgia, the Wuxtrees and Wax and Facts and places like that, all those places have gone back to stocking mostly vinyl. Most places are doing, you know, some used CDs, but maybe no new CDs. It's really the prevalent way that people are buying music right now.
That is Ryan Lewis. He's the president of Kindercore Vinyl in Athens. Ryan, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's add some music to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. And the rules are simple. All the tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians cannot pick one of their own songs. Today's picks come from Vanessa Briscoe Hay. She's lead singer of the legendary Athens group Pylon, and she brings these songs.
Hi, this is Vanessa Briscoe Hay. I'm speaking to you from Athens, Georgia, and I'm the singer for Pylon, Supercluster, and now Pylon Reenactment Society. Today, my first pick for the Georgia playlist is one of my favorite songs from 1968. It's by the Classics Four, and it's called Spooky.
First you say no, you got some plans for the night, and then you stop and say,
what you've got is you've got a band who's telling a story about a spooky little girl like you in 3 minutes. It has a really nice kind of jazzy, bluesy bottom to it. It kind of snakes around and twists in there. The saxophone is very important. There's maybe a progenitor of what became soft rock. Spooky is a very appropriate name for the song.
Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little girl like you.
The song itself was actually taken from a jazz standard, and some members of the Classics Four had decided to add lyrics to it. It started out as a jazz saxophone, kind of bluesy kind of song, and then when you hear the song, you'll hear the lyrics as it's playing, but it kind of appealed to me as a kid because it was talking about a a girl who was a little bit different. Spooky little girl like you. Spooky. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is from 1978 by Atlanta's own The Brains, and it's called Money Changes Everything. It goes out to my dear friend, Margaret Adams. You know, it kind of represents what Atlanta was about at the time. It's very poppy, very well written, and synthesizer driven. Tom Gray released this initially as a single, and on the basis of the single, the Brains were signed to Mercury Records. This is just like a perfect pop song. They're like at the top of their game. The instruments are all very together, very professional sounding, which was maybe more of a hallmark to an Atlanta sound than Athens. I mean, there were a lot of bands that never really got signed or moved beyond the area. The Brains were one of the ones who did. When you hear a really good pop song like that, you realize what makes it tick. And to me, the clearness of the lyrics and the sentiment really come through. It's a just very punchy, very hooky pop song. I don't know that Pylon were ever accused of being very hooky or punchy or any of that. We were maybe left field from that. But I can say that I enjoyed that. And I had many friends in Atlanta who were associated with that band.
That's singer Vanessa Briscoe Hay with the Athens band Pylon Reenactment Society. They perform at 529 Bar in Atlanta on December 29th. And that's our show for today, but we'd love to hear from you. You know that. What defines good music to you? Does it matter if artists can actually reproduce their recordings in a live setting? You know how to reach us? Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.